It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we are here on this yet again delightful Saturday morning in Northeast Florida. And, of course, it's a very special weekend for the sports fans out there with Florida, Georgia. And I always admonish everyone, a lot of people in from out of town, don't know the roads as well as we do, probably aren't as good at drivers as we are in the first place since they're from Georgia. Oh, excuse me. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Anyway, cut them a little slack. They're bringing their uber-sized American Express cards to town, and they're going to crank up the economy for a while. So live and let live and have a good time, and I hope your team wins. Have no idea who will be favored on that one, but I don't think they're from south of the line.
Yeah, you obviously don't follow college football that closely. Georgia's the reigning national champions and undefeated. Yeah. And 14.5-point favorites. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, maybe with the spread. maybe not. We'll see. Just play well and hope nobody gets hurt.
I did take the Gators with the spread, so we'll see. So,
okay.
Well, so we're cheering for a close game.
All right. That seems like a reasonable thing to do. Anyway, for those of you who are new to the show, please try to stick around and join all of the others who have been around for these 9.5 years or so. And you'll learn something. You'll always learn something. We promise very little, but we'll promise you that you'll learn something. How much it's worth to you depends on what you make of it in some cases. So listen along and see, and we'll talk about whatever we want to talk about, unless, of course, you pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255. I remind everybody that there are benefits to live radio. Far too many people who do what we do are not willing to go on a live show and potentially ask questions at random, but we are because we think it makes better radio, period. Plus, keeps us sharp. And I remind you, if you do call in with questions, that there are no such thing as easy questions because there's always somewhere out there that doesn't know what you don't know. And, of course, the easier the question seems, the more likely we are to answer it quickly and correctly, so you make us look good, and that is part of your job. We'll do our best to help you. All right, another week, another bummer. We're not having our October rally yet. I told Adam a couple minutes ago, there's still time for an October rally. We have Monday and Tuesday left, and other than that, this is being kind of a punishing month. And when you look at what goes on in the world, I don't know how you could possibly expect too much better, but these things have a tendency to evolve through the news cycles and other things come up, and it's not something that a year from now people are going to be paying much attention to in all likelihood. So we'll see what happens. Generally speaking, we're going into a couple of really good months to end the year. November typically the third best month, and December is typically the rally at the end of the year. And we'll just hope that all that comes true, and we'll see. Next year, another whole story. We'll talk about that later. But for now, just keep on keeping on and have a little fun between now and then. Don't take anything too seriously. Just pay attention.
Yep. So the world's largest cocktail party is going on downtown right now, and I'm pretty sure that there was no investors having cocktails, unless they were cocktails of sorrow this week. It was just bad. There was one good day sandwiched by a bunch of bad days. And the NASDAQ and the S&P both entered correction territory this week. The NASDAQ was down 2.6%, the S&P down 2.5%. The Dow dropped 2.1% and is now pretty solidly negative for the year. The S&P is still up 7.2% for the year, and the NASDAQ is up 20.8%. And if you hold QQQ, which is the NASDAQ 100, it's up about 30% this year still. So all is not lost, but it has been a really bad couple of months. The corrections are something that happen on average once a year. This is the first time this year it's happened, but there were three on the S&P last year. So we're above average at this point, not in a good way. The median correction lasts 97 days and drops 15.2%. This one may surprise you to learn. We're already 88 days in, and it's down just 10.2%. So we're actually close to the average correction length already. Both gold and Bitcoin spiked lately, and I think both of those are signaling a flight to safety, although I don't see why you would flee to Bitcoin for safety. That seems counterintuitive.
That is just a bit of an oxymoron, I think.
Mm-hmm. For the week, energy had the largest losses, kind of surprisingly, but it was down 6.24%. Communication services was off 5.16%. Utilities managed a small gain, up 1.2%. That was the only positive sector. And they're down pretty, they were down substantially in the last month. So may have been just like a little reversion to the mean type of trading there, and a little bit again of a flight to safety, although utilities have not been safe in the last month. Internationally, things were a bit better than here, with the all world except U.S. index dropping just 1.1% and emerging markets down just 0.7%. Mexico was once again a big winner, gaining 2.4%, while China was up 1.6% and Hong Kong up 0.4%. So Mexico's been pretty hot all year. China's been the opposite, Hong Kong as well. So kind of a smattering of different reactions across the world. I would have expected more reactions similar to the U.S. reaction this week than what we saw.
Well, Gavin Newsom went over there and is helping him out, so of course the market's going up.
I'm sure that had a lot to do with it.
Sure it did.
Israel was the worst performing market, down 4.2%, and is now down over 19% this year for pretty obvious reasons. Canada also lost 3% and is now negative for the year as well. Oil came down this week, and that, I'm sure, had something to do with why the energy sector performed so poorly. It really dragged down the commodities index by 0.5%. That was in spite of a surge in natural gas pricing, which was up over 6%, and gold was up 1.4%. So mixed on the commodities basket, but I think a lot of the downside had to do with oil, much like the 10% increase in the commodities basket last quarter, when oil was hitting 100. The fixed income finally had a good week. I haven't said that in a long time. Prices rose across the board as rates dropped slightly from around, if you look at the 10-year treasury, it was around 5% to start the week and below 4.9 to end the week. So you're hearing a lot about surging bond yields, but that didn't actually happen this week despite all the coverage it got on the news. The aggregate bond market was up about 60 basis points, and long treasuries were up 1.3%. So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about earnings, and we have some PMI, manufacturing and services data, and I think some of it might surprise you, a little bit counterintuitive from everything else that's going on.
This whole economy this year, and for a little longer ago than that even, has been a bit counterintuitive, or at least you could say confusing.
Or both,
yes. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I'll look them up in the break and see. But it has been a difficult thing to understand, and I'm sure right after the break you'll touch on that a little bit more too. So don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back after a short break. This is the Banway Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Banway Financial Hour. I'm Steve Banway.
And I'm Adam Banway.
And the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And we do have a trivia question today, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Excuse me. The generosity of Americans is something that we've been touching on lately, and of course it's legendary, and this time of year, of course, it gets nothing but better. What I want to know today is what generation of Americans gives the largest number of dollars per person out of all the various generations and descriptions among the American population? What generation is the most generous per person?
Okay.
All right. Real easy. Yeah. All right, back in the market, some other stuff.
Yeah, we've been going through earnings season. We're about halfway done. There has been 490 companies that have reported, and so far the results are somewhat average, maybe even slightly better than average, but the reaction to those results has been very negative, and the forward guidance is not good either. So 70% of companies have beat on their earnings estimates, while 58% have beat on their revenue estimates. So not great numbers, but really not horrible either, not worthy of a correction type numbers. So there must be something else going on there, like, you know, unsettled disputes in the Middle East and things like that.
Yeah. Expectations for this economy and the world are also very low right now.
That is also true. Most companies that have reported have seen their stock values decline in reaction to the reports. Even if they're really good reports, there have been exceptions, but most companies have gone down on the news. And so there's just a lack of enthusiasm even for good news right now. So it's one of those all news is bad news types of trades that are happening right now.
Yes, it is.
Globally, PMI readings have been getting worse since 2021, and both services and manufacturing are fairly deep into contraction territory, and they have been for quite some while. This is on a global basis. But in the U.S., things are actually much better, with both services and manufacturing just barely in expansion territory, but also in pretty solid uptrends. That is the opposite of what we're seeing worldwide. And while our market went down this week, the worldwide markets were generally flat to up, or maybe slightly negative, but, you know, much better than ours. So it's kind of a disconnect between the market and what's actually happening. And in fact, economists have been underestimating the strength of the U.S. economy for the last 2 years while overestimating the rest of the world during the same period. So we have been consistently beating expectations while Europe and other foreign areas have been underperforming relative to expectations. Kind of a weird phenomenon.
Yeah, I have more to say about that in a little bit, too.
The U.S. economy is so strong that the third quarter GDP that was released this week showed the economy grew at a 4.9% pace, which is much higher than the 4.5% that was forecast, and up from 2.1% in the second quarter. We also saw, at the same time, continuing jobless claims rise about 8% over the last 5 weeks, which generally happens only during recessions. So obviously we're not in a recession with the GDP growing at that shocking rate. So I guess it's just another example of a data point that doesn't match up in this weird economy. You've got one thing signaling that we're solidly in a recession, and yet the data coming in saying we grew at a record rate in the last quarter. I can't explain it.
I can.
Okay, go ahead.
Lucky you. Okay, the Heritage Foundation, I believe it was, kind of tore this thing apart. A Daily Caller reports this. The reason for this sudden big jump, unexpected big jump from 2.1 in the third quarter, or in the second to the third quarter, 4.9 year over year.
It wasn't unexpected. Everyone expected this quarter to be big.
Yeah, it was expected to be higher. It wasn't expected to be that high.
I did read some reports that forecasted at 5%, so that was pretty accurate.
The only ones I've read were 4.1 and 4.6.
Oh, okay.
One way or the other, it was pretty good. But why? Well, you can thank pretty much Uncle Sam, because who's spending the money out there? Well, turns out that there's two things happening. Private companies are building inventory, and the government is blowing through money like never before. And part of that is defense related. So what has happened now, if the inventory build, we were having a lot of trouble maintaining inventories for a while, partly because of strikes. You know, these labor strikes impact an awful lot of people, and probably still some after effects of the supply chain problems. But anyway, in the GDP, building inventory added 1.32% out of the 4.9. So that it was necessary, but it was one time, because in the previous two quarters, one quarter ago, that number was zero, and two quarters ago, it actually subtracted 2.22 from the first quarter. So if you average those up, the average inventory build for those three quarters is actually minus 0.3. So we haven't really added much. What we did was push inventory into the quarter that just ended, making a remarkable increase in GDP that will not repeat itself in the fourth quarter. So how big that'll turn out, I'm not quite sure. The other part was government spending, which is less overall than America's. Now, Americans are spending well. went up again by 4% instead of 0.8, the one before that. Durable goods rose. So the 70% of the economy that's consumer-driven is doing okay. But there's even something you have to know about that. What has happened to the savings and the private community, you know, regular old people, we have, in this past quarter alone, we dropped off another $200 billion in that term I hate that I mentioned again last year, excess savings. But if you look back to the high point in COVID, there were $6 trillion in the hands of Americans as savings. That is now 0.8 or $800 million in savings. We have blown through, out of that $6 trillion, $5.2 trillion in savings. That is what has been spurring the consumer portion of this economy. And it is not dry yet, but you can see where it might be running dry. And now recently, we've had the return to having pay off student loans. That's taking more money out of people's pockets without really doing any good for the economy. It doesn't circulate, just repays debt. So there's some things that are likely to not be repeated. So don't be surprised if this falls quite a bit. And then the government spending is absolutely astronomical, but it isn't really limited to the federal government. State governments are doing the same thing. They were up 3.7% in the third quarter, and they were up earlier than that, 4.7% in the second quarter. So it's just, it's not all smoke and mirrors. Of course, things are better than a lot of people would think just looking around and listening, but it's not as good as the Bidenomics gurus and cheerleaders would like to have you believe, and they're going to have a real tough time starting next year. And, of course, starting next year is when the political season really heats up. So we'll see how it goes. But meanwhile, how are things? Not bad. Really? Not bad.
Depends who you ask. I would say the average person would say that they're kind of bad.
And that has been the problem for a year and a half or so now.
It has. Even when things were way less bad than they are now.
Yeah.
People were saying
how are things?
So.
Things are good. Look at all the numbers. Things are good. Look at the traffic. Look at the restaurants. Look at the bars. Everything's good. Then you ask any one person on the street how they're doing, whether they're scared of losing their jobs, everything's way too expensive, on and on and on, complain, 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 and I could not possibly blame them. Because we pay the same prices for things that they do. So this is not over yet. Where it'll land, I don't know. The Fed is in a very, very difficult slash impossible place right now. If they're going to do what they want to do, and you saw that this week too, and the inflation numbers failed to come down more. In fact, they ticked up just a little bit in some respect. But you know and I know that things are coming down faster than what you're seeing on those numbers because commodity prices are still here and there falling. And that, where that ends, I'm not exactly sure. Will the Fed raise again this year? I read one today that said absolutely they're going to raise in the next two meetings. And then it was refuted saying absolutely not. And the truth is probably closer to not, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, they realize that some of the stuff is going to take a while. Now, again, I say it's the simplest thing in the world to fix. Drill, baby, drill. Take control of the energy supply. Shipping and so on is still way, way, way too high. We're paying too much for gas. Consumers don't have the amount of money that they need to get by with prices like this. And overall price levels would start to fall with the price of energy. But it won't happen. So we're going to have to see where it lands. It's going to be interesting. I will take another short break. We've got a lot of stuff for after the break, and we'll see you then. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And remind everyone that the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question remains out there. What generation of Americans gives the most dollars per person of any of our various and sundry, quite several actual generations? And might be surprised. Never know. All right. One more little thing on the economy. Another warning sign. More subprime borrowers are falling behind on car loans. This is a leading indicator of nothing good, I would say. subprime borrowers 60 days or more behind is the highest rate ever recorded. Car payments, as we've been talking for quite some time, are far more expensive than they were just a few years ago, partly due to interest rates and partly due to the extremely quickly rising prices for cars, both new and used, and the vulnerability of households who aren't quite as well off now as they were. You know, there are certain things that you absolutely have to do, and eating is right up there. That's costing people a lot more money. But so is transportation. And if you need a car to get where you're going, it's more expensive to buy. It's more expensive to lease. It's more expensive to fill up, fix, et cetera, et cetera. And it's causing a problem. There are a lot of people now paying four-digit car payments. And we've talked about this on and off for the last year or two. But when you get over $1,000 a month, and I'm not talking about your highest line Tesla or a real snazzy sports car or anything. I'm talking about a good car, which now new ones are up to an average of about $48,000, which is about $10,000 more than just pre-pandemic pricing. That's quite a bit when you add in some recent interest rate increases. So here's what happens. Car repossessions rose 28% in August compared to the same month in 2022. Look for that to continue. And as they say in economics, no good can come of that.
If you borrow $48,000, you said that's the average cost of a new car, for 60 months at 8%, it's $973 a month.
And so there you go.
Pretty easy to see how you could get to $1,000. I mean, that's the average car. So if you want something slightly above average, you're probably borrowing a little bit more.
Some of the new car loans that are just coming out recently are 9.9% too.
Yeah.
See what that would do to that.
Yeah. I've seen Bank of America sent me a thing the other day. They were at like 6.5 for a new car from a dealer, which I thought was fairly good.
Today?
Sure. Yeah. You'd probably have to have excellent credit.
How many years?
To get that. I think it was 60 months.
Yeah. Well, that's not as bad. Well, the other thing we've been railing about is some of these 6 and 7 year loans now. And I know cars are much better than they used to be, but a 7 year car loan?
Yeah, you better get your gap insurance. But don't buy it from the dealer. That's actually a pretty good tip. You can buy it from the dealer. It'll cost you maybe $400 at the beginning of the loan. Or if you contact your car insurance company, they'll probably give it to you for something like less than $10 every 6 months. Yeah.
Wow. And pay as you go too.
Yeah. And then you can cancel it once the gap is closed. So,
but you think about that in 7 years, how many times are you going to have new tires, new brakes? And we're talking about putting a lot of money into that car as it gets older and older and older.
Yeah. But if you're going to buy new, keeping it 7 years is probably a good idea.
Yeah, it is.
If you want to make it worth it.
And do your research on the car, too, and see. Some of them tend to last a lot longer than others.
Yeah, definitely look at the reliability ratings.
Yeah. The manufacturing, and you know, certainly in my adult lifetime and even in your adult lifetime, things have gotten so much better. Foreign cars really caused the domestic manufacturers to step up, and they did. In fact, when I was young, way young, I got involved in some quality control stuff at the domestic manufacturers, things like tractors and so on, where the whole concept of statistical process control was coming into being, and we were training people about it and then how to implement it. And it was very interesting, and you could see it take effect. And I'll be honest, I was a manufacturer at the time, and I fought it. And I said, you're not talking to the right people. You got to talk to the people who turn steel and cut it, because those are the ones that can't keep track of the process. And they said, no, it's for everybody. Well, I ate crow eventually and said, yes, it is for everybody. And as it got implemented, it worked. And now cars are much better than they used to be. And if you go way, way back, if you're as old as people like me, and you might remember Dr. Edwards Deming, who sort of concocted statistical process control, took it to the American automobile manufacturers. They laughed him out of town, so he hopped on a boat, went to Japan, and he talked to them, and they weren't laughing. So he actually implemented it in Japan, and but I'm talking a long time ago now. When I was really young, in college, I would pumping gas for a living while I was going to school. And when the original Toyotas came in, we would laugh. And you'd hear such things as, don't slam the door, it's a Toyota. And then one year, a new Toyota came in, and it was perfect. And it went thunk, and everything fit perfectly. And from that day on, we knew Detroit's in a lot of trouble if they're going to let this happen and not respond. And thankfully, they did eventually respond.
Yeah, they did under the name of Six Sigma, which is something if you've been involved in any kind of manufacturing company.
Yeah, when you were in that same age group and going through all this, that became the...
Yeah, you've definitely been exposed to it if you've worked for any company that manufactures anything in the U.S. in the last 30, 40 years. It's definitely something that's almost universal now.
Yeah, I wonder how many cars now get returned under the Lemon Law. I bet it's really rare.
I bet it is fairly small, but... I don't know.
I remember a long time ago, Chevy was trying to make a point when the Six Sigma thing was coming in. So they handpicked a series of parts, and they made two cars absolutely identical. Absolutely. Everything was exactly identical, except that one was an inch longer than the other one. And when you think about that, an inch on a car.
Yeah, that's...
That's a lot of...
That's a whole lot of gaps. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why they brought the variances down, and now you can get cars that look like and sound like they're really well made, because they are. Oh, and speaking of which, there's been a tentative agreement at Ford, and I heard this morning that Stellantis and GM have come up with the same pay raise, and they're talking. You know that they had two choices. One would be to match Ford's offer, and the other one would be to go out of business. So what do you think they're doing?
Probably the first one.
Yeah, I think 20 years ago, maybe they would have tried the second one, but they're not that dumb anymore. So congratulations to all of them. Strikes help no one. I don't care what your position is on unions or anything like that. It helps no one, and I'll be very happy when it gets running again, and so will the economy. That has hurt the economy, too, and it has a little uncertainty factor to what's going on out there, and we don't need that right now. We'd rather see them fire up. Okay. Anyway, once in a while, you strike a chord, more or less by accident, and we start hearing from people, and that happened just last week. We got talking about the deed problems that you're hearing so much about on television right now, where people come in and they put loans on your property, and you don't know about it, and all of a sudden, you think you own it outright, and you don't. Well, a while back, a couple of years, 3 years ago, whatever, we started talking about this and said, don't worry about it, because it's so rare, it's not going to happen. But they said at the time that it was the fastest growing white collar crime in America. So we watched on, and pretty soon you started hearing about more of these things. And it wasn't long after that that an alert listener, I think it's somebody you've all heard of, told us that there was a service at the county level that would do essentially what the, what do they call that service, alert, the
which one?
title service.
Like Title Lock or...
Yeah, Title Lock.
Something like that, I don't know.
Which, of course, is very happy to charge you a monthly fee to tell you that somebody is making changes on your title or trying to. Well, the county clerks in the area sort of jumped on that bandwagon, and they're offering it for free. Now, I'm telling people who are computer literate, even a little bit, that you can do this and you don't have to pay Title Lock. Now, if you absolutely, positively don't do computers, you might want to look at Title Lock, just because it could happen. It's still rare, but it could, and it would not be a pleasant sight, especially if you're a little older. So when I got home, I got a little help from another friend of the show. Most of you have heard from Lane on and off. We talk on the phone frequently, and he has dealt with governments and such. He seems to have the perfect combination of the knowledge and the temperament to to actually look into things and try them out. So he went through it and sent it to me, and I promised him I'd put it on air. And he used the example of Duval County. He doesn't live there, but he knows most of the people listening are there, or St. John's. So he sent me what to do, and he said, suggest you try it once to verify before sharing.
I did.
I did too.
And Duval, you didn't, obviously, in Duval.
I did. I went to Duval to try it.
Okay.
For all the not because of mine. I just wanted to see if what he said was okay. Right. So the website was DuvalClerk.com.
Mm-hmm.
I put that in this morning, and bang, it came up like fast. Click on services. It's in the upper row in the blue line. And under services, a drop-down menu comes down, and it says property fraud alert. Clicked on that, boom, right in.
Mm-hmm.
It was the simplest possible thing. The directions are right there. So because I live in St. John's County, I figured, okay, we've got a lot of audience in St. John's County too. So I went there, and I got in at co.county.stjohns, no period, but there's a dash after the ST, -johns.fl.us. And I tried to get anywhere, and the whole site was non-cooperative and wouldn't go anywhere.
Huh.
So I'll let you know next week on that one. Well, I have a feeling they were doing a little maintenance on the site or something.
The Duval one worked great. I did it as soon as we got that email from Lane, and I appreciate him sending that. So
yeah, and I know the chances of him listening now are somewhere around 99%. So Lane, on behalf of the show and all the people listening, thank you. DuvalClerk.com, services, property fraud alert. And they will tell you within 48 hours of anybody trying to do anything with or to your property title, and you don't have to pay for it. Well, let me rephrase that. You have already paid for it.
Yes,
when you pay your
that's
taxes.
More accurate. Yeah.
Nothing in government is free. It's just sometimes prepaid. You all know that. All right, we'll be right back with lots more. Don't go anywhere. This is the Vanway Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanway Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanway.
And I'm Adam Vanway.
And Lane just sent us a little text and said that you're welcome. So everybody knows he was actually listening. But I'll check in next week again and let you know how it goes with my little trials and tribulations at St. John's County. So I must have just hit it at the absolutely worst possible time. All right, you got anything you want to stick in here before I hit my stack?
Go for it.
All righty. The F word in our business, and I do mean fiduciary. We talk about it a lot. A lot of people talk about it a lot. And for probably as many years as we've been doing this radio program, the government has been trying to figure out how to define a fiduciary, because there's an awful lot of people out there who are involved in helping other people's retirement plans who have a lot of problem with the term advice and fiduciary. Now, what constitutes advice is, the oldest problem in financial planning, right? When do you become someone who's giving advice to somebody? When you sell them an insurance product, or when you take them on as a fee-only financial planner, or whatever. But a fiduciary has to put the client's interests first, and that means that you can't get into a situation with a conflict of interest. And most people agree that when you're selling products, annuities, insurance products, and so on, for a commission, that you have an automatic conflict of interest, therefore cannot be a fiduciary. And a lot of people have a problem with that because they want to be able to be called fiduciaries, because people are now learning to ask if you're a fiduciary. And if they have to say no, a lot of people walk away from them. And I'll let you guess how I feel about that, because we are and always have been fiduciaries. So the Labor Department has tried and tried and tried and tried to find a definition that works for everybody. They passed one in 2016, and they called it the Conflict of Interest Rule. Well, it was immediately challenged from all directions, and it was taken to court. And it was thrown out because it was just too... they say complicated. I think what it means is it irritated the wrong people, and they threw it out. Well, there's a new one coming out now, supposedly, and it could be released any day. And I looked into it a little bit, and here's what I found that bothers me. It says it's the retirement security rule. Okay, automatically the hairs on the back of my neck stand up when I see the government talking about the retirement security rule with respect to the definition of an investment advice fiduciary. Okay, sounds good, though, because I think everybody should try to be one except the people who only sell commission products, period. So the new rule, I got to this line that I've read this line about 15 times, and I still don't like it. Will still cover who is a fiduciary for the purposes of providing investment advice for a fee. Now, did anybody else just hear that and say, well, you don't need a fiduciary rule for people doing investment advice for a fee. You need it for people selling investment products for a commission. So it looks to me, and the more I read, the more I think, when this thing does come out, all it's going to be is another word salad. It would be good enough for our esteemed vice president word salad, all dressed up to look like they finally did a fiduciary rule. And in the analysis that I've done so far, we'll say this, I can't guarantee I'll be right forever. It looks to me like all they're doing is beating around the issue and they haven't solved a thing. Therefore, whenever you are dealing with or about to deal with a financial advisor and dealing in retirement situations or pre-retirement situations, always ask, are you a fiduciary? There are only two answers to that. One is yes, and the other one is bye-bye. Get up and leave. There. Typical, isn't it? Speaking of government, sometimes they do something that's good and not everybody likes it. There is a proposal out there now. They call it the auto IRA, where the government would sponsor IRAs for people who do not have access to company plans. And the way it would work is you'd have automatic enrollment, and once you're enrolled, you could opt out. It would even cover people who do 1099 work, gig work. You could get into this. You could contribute between 1% and 4% of your income, and the government would match it up to 4%. And there's a little bit of that that bothers me, but then again, maybe not all that much, because you're talking about the lower income people who are never going to have a chance at a really good retirement unless something like this spurs them into moving, especially early. But it would be portable. From job to job, you can still take it with you. It's all Roth style. Nobody gets a tax deduction. They do get the matches, and it could be invested such as with the TSP, with the giant and inexpensive funds that they own. All in all, it sounds to me like something really worth a good discussion, and I could easily back it. So, of course, the very next article you can pull up says, the federal auto IRA would crowd out private sector plans, critics say.
So no way.
That's not true. I know.
It's not true.
You're not. Folks, we deal in this stuff all the time and have for decades. If somebody who has just started a $30,000 a year job and has no assets and nothing else to show for it, no ability to even start a reasonable Roth IRA because nobody will deal with them but that little bit of money. Well, how about this? Auto IRA, get matching funds, get them going, come and see us in a couple of years. How's that?
Yeah, I don't mind it. I do wish that there was a better alternative to the traditional and Roth IRA options that you could save more for people who do not have a plan. That doesn't cover what I'm looking for. I think it's ridiculous that if you have a 401k at work, you can put away $22,000 a year, and if you don't have one at work, you can put away $6,500 a year. That doesn't make any sense.
And if you have the right kind of employment, such as in a partnership or something, and a real solid job, like your physician in a good practice or something, you can do a lot better than that
by
making
grand.
A personal pension
Or well, in that, yeah, or a solo K or SEP, 60 grand a year, and there, but if you're just have a regular income and a regular 1099 job, you're maxed out at 6,500. It's ridiculous.
Why?
It makes no sense.
Speaking of which, that's likely to go up. I keep telling you, as IRS releases its new numbers, we're very likely to have increases in contribution levels. And for instance, the free gifting, the amount you can give, any one person can do another one, that's probably going to go up 1,000. But everything I'm reading so far is still speculative and has yet to be confirmed. So when it is confirmed, I'll tell you all. But there will undoubtedly, due to the inflation over the 12-month period where these things are calculated, there will undoubtedly be some substantial increases. But the problem is exactly as Adam just said. They're going off the same base and making little incremental changes. We got to rethink this whole thing about the IRA versus the personal 401k and the 401k plans, 403bs. It's just totally and completely inadequate for individual savers trying to do a good job for retirement. Maybe the annuity companies are in on it. I don't know, but it has been inadequate.
Did you catch the very popular article in the Wall Street Journal this week about it was titled "Your Set It and Forget It 401k Made You Rich, No More"?
I did not see that.
Yeah, they're arguing that that's dead. You might as well just give up. You have to rethink the way you're saving for retirement because the last couple of years have been different than the previous 10. It's really a dumb article. It's designed to get people to take it to their financial advisor and say, what are you doing about this?
Doing?
Yeah. It's completely ridiculous.
There are some things that get published that just make you shudder.
It was the number one trending article one day this week on the Wall Street Journal.
Remember around 08, I guess it was, when things were falling apart, and how many articles did you see that said that
the 60-40
portfolio, dead, RIP.
They're still writing them. You can find one just about every month for the last 24 months.
And you could find a couple of years where they were absolutely right. It didn't work.
Of course.
At all. And one of them being, what, 22?
22. Yeah. You could argue 23. It's vastly underperformed the NASDAQ. And it depends what you compare it to, though.
Then what happens? A couple years later, you look at the results. And they're right back where you were.
Well, the 3-year annualized return on bonds is below 5% right now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, of course your 60-40 portfolio is going to be sucking a little bit of wind when that happens.
So what would you do about it? Just ignore bonds for the rest of your life?
No, rebalance into more bonds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But when it's down, you buy. Yeah. When it's up, you sell. Yeah. People, 24/7 news and the media all over the place. People trying to get their name in print, all that. You can read as many stupid articles as you want. I've got one that I keep wanting to get around to. It says, reasons to convert your Roth IRA to a traditional. I said, well, that's a brilliant article since that's not possible. You can't convert a Roth to a traditional. You can only convert a traditional to a Roth. And you get into the reasons. The reasoning in the article is not half bad. It's just doesn't. The writer didn't know anything about how things are done, apparently. It's absolutely ludicrous. Yeah, well, we've got to have some fun, too, as planners. They're called the greatest generation, or, in this article, traditionalists, people older than us. See you next.